you know, there was a coach and a player that were at odds with one another, and I was the captain in the middle.
A young captain at 21, a young coach at 34, and a still young assistant coach at 43, wanting to be a senior coach again. Michael Voss's extraordinary journey through football has had some amazing highs and some painful lows, but throughout it all, he has always maintained his class, and he's never lost his hunger for competition. We're with Michael Voss on this week's In The Game. Vossy, thanks for your time.
No worries, Damo.
The 43-year-old, nearly 44-year-old Michael Voss, is he still the competitive beast that he was as an 18-year-old?
Geez, you opened up well there, Damo. Showing my age straight away. No, I think I've a little bit more subdued than what I was, but I still love winning. So you still throw a game of Scrabble out and a game of Monopoly, and I'll give it my best shot. And there's no free hits to my kids, that's for sure. So
still, so, even after all this time.
Still got to earn their stripes, yeah. So they're better for it. But, I mean, the reason why I still coach and love what I do is because the competitive element of the game. Lee Matthews had sort of said it to me, and it made complete sense to me. It's that hole in the stomach that you can never fill up. You try to as a competitor, but you never become full. And so I'll just keep trying to fill it up and keep going back to the well.
So you still love the game?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's been my life. So from a very young age. Even to the point with my family have been so ingrained in whether it's been local sport back in or Boston. Mm. And I've just grown up around it. So, my dad's coached it. He's played it. He's the president of the Morningside Football Club. So we almost half lived at a football club for probably 4 or 5 years there in our first few years in Queensland when he was president of the Morningside Football Club. So. It's been my whole life and I love the game, looking at it, enjoying it and watching it.
He famously got locked inside the Gabba, didn't he, the night you won the Brownlow medal? While the count was in Melbourne, he was watching it at a big screen in Brisbane and they just locked him in there.
Yeah, no, not too many people know that story, but he was enjoying the festivities and had disappeared and they couldn't quite find him. Apparently, he might have gone into the wrong set of toilets and fallen asleep after a very big night, and they closed up the doors. And when he woke up, everything was dark and locked up, and the only way he could get out was climb through a window and down a downpipe, which was pretty impressive when you're considering it's about 3 stories high. So how he did that, I don't know, but that's certainly gone into footy folklore. It's certainly our family folklore stories, that's for sure.
Still reminded?
Oh, it doesn't come up often, but always gets a laugh when around the kitchen table, that's for sure, when we do raise it because, whether it's his grandkids and, we've just obviously had a really strong family for such a long period of time and, we love each other's company and so like having a laugh together and certainly the grandkids enjoy listening to pop stories and that's one of them.
Yeah. So, as you've mentioned there already, Orbost, Morningside, living in Brisbane, now in Adelaide. It's a journey you're obviously half completed on.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of reflect because, I think why I still consider, Queensland is my home. I've spent such a long period of time there. I love the city. Obviously a lot of my family are there. But the weather and the lifestyle, and I still consider that home and always will. We decided to take a different, route and go to Adelaide. We felt like we wanted to do something different with my wife and obviously my kids and we've loved it. It's been such a great change for us. Enjoy the city. Obviously the job's good, but more importantly, it was a great move for our family and our kids. They've really grown as people over that period of time and they've enjoyed the change.
Yeah. Michael, I dare say it would have been a tough time for you and the family at the time in question when you made that decision to leave the home, given what had happened to you. And I suppose the unknown at your life there, obviously a year after not having the Brisbane Lions coaching job and having a very successful year in the media that year, and we'll touch on that in a moment, but the unknown of that period, can I just take you back to that moment and what it made you do?
Yeah, well, it was always, I think, I was always going to go back into coaching. I probably didn't anticipate that it was going to be as quick after. I was quite content doing the media and really enjoying that.
You hosted your own TV show too.
Yeah, I had TV shows. I had a great variety in what I was doing, whether it was reality TV, which I never thought I'd be coach of reality TV. I mean, that's something I never thought would be on my resume, but...
Award-winning too, wasn't it?
Award-winning. Yeah. It was, really, it was fantastic experience. Yeah. You know, I did go back to that. When it was first pitched to me...
We're talking about The Recruit, yes, on the Fox platform?
On Fox 8, yeah. And when it was first pitched to me as an idea, I thought, oh, this is a gimmick, like, you know. And I was pretty conscious at that time that, you know, I didn't want to necessarily go into something that was gimmicky. So there was an element of risk-taking to take that on. But then after the first day when we did the filming, my fears were laid. It was incredibly professional. You could tell that the product was going to be of a really high standard. The resources were well and truly there. Very professional people to work with, and a lot of creative minds. I loved it. It was just such a great experience. And it got me away from, I guess, the bubble of what, you know, inside Clubland can give you at times. Mm-hmm. Gave me a really different perspective on things. And I love that time in the media. And it was a really, really tough decision to make to then step back into coaching. But we sort of – the kids were probably the ones that really in the end got me over the line because – you know, they pretty much said, well, if we're going to move, if that's likely, then we'd like it to be this year, not next year. Right. And that was more the phase of their schooling and where they were at, given the fact that they were in year 10 and they didn't want to move in year 11.
Because all they'd known, obviously.
That's all they'd known. Point. And so it was a really, you know, for them to be able to have that level adult of discussion. Yeah. And we sort of felt like it was critically important to involve them in the decision. And, you know, we clearly know that the parents are still the ones that have to make the end call. Mm. But when they said that, that made real sense to me, sounded like a really mature response. And so we made the call. And that was, probably against, something that was going quite well with the media and really enjoyed it. But in the end, That hunger for competition, Damo, was the thing that got me back in.
Yeah. And Michael, I don't want this to sound too simplistic, but by going back to a senior assistant coaching role, as you chose to do then, and now into its fifth year with Port Adelaide, did you do so? And do you continue to do so with the view to again becoming the main man at a footy club?
Well, that's certainly a long-term objective. I mean, you've known me long enough to know that I tend not to look that far in front, but I am a goal setter as well, and I've never tried to shy away. That's been an end goal, but at the same time, I'm always really, really conscious that where I'm at, they know they get the absolute best out of me, and they get the best of me, and you throw everything into it, and I don't know another way. You're 100% in or you're 100% out, and it's something that I've always live by, and I've really learned just so much about coaching by my time being there, and working with Ken has been absolutely brilliant. It's taught me a lot of things, about coaching. The list has evolved, our game style's changed, a couple of times, and how we've gone about educating that. So it's it was an important step. It was a necessary step if eventually that does happen. Now, whether that does on or not, I don't know. I don't know whether there's an industry we're ready to have that conversation around second-time coaches.
It doesn't seem right, though, does it? Because everyone I speak to would argue that the second time round you're going to be better. It's just that the second time round doesn't often present itself to the person who's missed after a first go, has it?
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. There's probably more people that need to have that debate more than me. But I was a young captain at 21. You could probably argue that without being the captain at 21, would I have been as good a captain at 26 when we were premierships? And I made a lot of mistakes. I mean, you were there at the time when we finished dead last in 1998. The club was turned upside down.
You had a broken leg in that year.
I had a broken leg in Perth. The club was capitulating. Board was pretty much getting sacked. Coaches were getting sacked. So it was a really, really tough time to have to lead through that time when really I was a novice, really as a captain, and to work the way through that, and then obviously have Lee and being understand what he, what leadership really was, learn a lot of important lessons off Lee around that, and then you grow as a person. And so to me, that's only natural. But at the same time, You know, there's probably a conversation there for someone else, but for me, it's just more just about getting the job done and giving the best of yourself.
And when you refer to, as you did a few moments ago, to the best of me, was it the best of you when you were coach for the Brisbane Lions for those 5 years?
Oh, well, you always think so at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm always a believer that you're giving the best of what you got. And at the time when I, if I reflect back on it, you know, I was obviously, it was a tough job to take on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we just concentrate on experience alone, I mean, normally the job, it's become even bigger again since that period of time. And so with the skill sets at the time and the knowledge I had at the time, absolutely got the best. Now, as I said, when in that press conference, it was got the best, but it wasn't good enough. And sometimes that happens. And I thought that's a really important message also to my own kids, was that, you know what, sometimes you give your best and sometimes you don't get what you want. And it doesn't mean you don't try again.
Was that the first time in your life that you'd given your best and it hadn't worked?
Oh, no, there's plenty of other times. You know, like whenever I'd do a little bit of corporate speaking and, you know, a lot of my stories are, you know, funny enough, have been around when things haven't worked and how really? That's propelled me into other other things. And, you know, whether that was the broken leg that it happened in 1998 and working through that and the club, you know, almost imploding. Well, you know, the era that eventuated was on the back of that, and the decisions that were made were on the back of that. You know, share stories around some of my time with Wolsey and some of the direct feedback that I got off him over my time, and really tested and challenged me as a footballer, but also my own football character. And you know, without those conversations and going to a pretty bad place, you know, you might not eventuate being a Best and Fairest winner and a Brownlow Medal winner. So they're really important stories for me, and they're the ones in some ways that actually define me more than some of the successes that I've had. And we tend to look at the CV and the resume and they read that out, but there's a whole other resume that I have that that people don't see but have probably defined me more.
Right. And to that point, to a point, I mean, one of the All-Australian nominations you got out of the five came in the 1999 season when you played with a steel rod basically all the way up your leg.
That was without doubt close to my hardest year in football because I couldn't train at all during the week. And I sort of describe after that when I came back for that year, almost 2 weeks before the season started, I almost thought my year was over. Such was the pain that I was getting in my leg. And when people ask me, well, what did it feel like? I said, well, it almost feels like that when you're running or you get to a point in the game, it feels like, you know, when you get two steel rods and you bang them together and you get that shake through your hands. Yeah. That's what it felt like.
Every step.
As the game went on, yes. And then sort of in the first following days after a game, that's what it'd feel like. And so to be able to get through the 1999 year, having had very limited preparation and then also not training throughout the season and to still get All-Australian, that was without doubt one of the better achievements that I've had.
Really? Yeah. And making a preliminary final out of nowhere too.
Yeah. And then being able to finish that off. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was a different story there. But obviously, my ankle didn't play against North in that particular final. But yeah, at the end of the year, I had that right out and that made such a difference. You know, I couldn't have played without it in 99. It would have been too big a risk because the bone would have been too weak and chance of breaking it again. But, gee, when I had it out, I knew it was the right decision.
Yeah. Just back onto the coaching side of it, Michael, and we'll move on to other aspects of your life in a moment. But do you feel you're ready now? If someone knocked on the door when you leave this studio today and said, we've got a job for you at a senior level, are you ready now?
Well, I couldn't answer that without necessarily creating a headline demo, but no, I mean, the reality is that I'm a very different, coach to when I turned up on that first day at the Brisbane Lions. You know, I guess for me is that if my name won me the first job, you'd like to think your coaching skill sets win you the next one. You know, that experience that you've been able to generate over a long period of time, You learn a heap. You're certainly more defined in the philosophies and that you have as a coach, and get to learn more about what works and what doesn't work. But it's just constantly challenging. The whole environment's changing. I mean, even in the space of 3 or 4 years, and you look at what Richmond are doing and Collingwood around this connection piece, and how players now process information and showing vulnerability, and I mean, even that's changed. You know, like once upon a time when that was in my era coming through, if there was an element of vulnerability showed, you'd almost classify it as weak. Mm. It was more about strength and showing strength, and
poster boy for that, weren't you? For a period, I mean, you did have vulnerabilities privately, but when it came to presenting to your footy club and the broader footy world, that was you, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I've always, I always have believed that the one thing that I think has changed a lot in AFL football in general is that, you know, you used to go to football and you'd be a footballer. You go train and you go, and once you walked out that door, you had your life. And they were quite separate. And whereas now with the social media and the lifestyle, it's now just all merged. Players are now identities, and personalities, and they've got presence on social media and, seeking likes and all these things that go on now. So their football now transcends into their life, whereas when I played, it was very much
compartmentalized.
Into what you could do. So it was almost like, don't bring your life into your football. So I always had a really big thing around there was whenever I turned that handle every day and I went to go downstairs into the Brisbane Lions facility, I had to be on. I had to be consistent. I couldn't be this moody guy that was up and down. They had to know that they had a leader that was composed, was sure, was certain, knew where we needed to go. And in some ways, I'll show you how to get there in the way you went about it. And whereas now we probably embrace the fact that people bring their story.
Yep.
We embrace the fact that we ask them to bring their story. We ask them to share it. We ask them to open their own lives up and give us an insight in what they're going through. And that the stuff that's now going on in life has a direct relation to, in some instances, around how they perform. And so we have to understand that. We have to get to know the player at a really deeper level than once there was. And resources say we can do that better now. And so that's where the landscape has generally changed.
Do you like the change?
I do. It's I don't know whether it's just me as a person who's more evolved.
And a father now.
And a father.
Beyond teenagers.
And sort of getting understand all that. But, the language change, and I'm sure we had our own language as well. But, learning the vernacular that they have. And I remember I went to listen to one of the former All Blacks coaches speak, and he said, "Well, look, I have to acknowledge that it's me that has to change, and because this is where the momentum is going, this is what's actually happening now. The old school values still live; they're still strong, but you also have to acknowledge that it's like, well, that wave of momentum that you have, and the just pure demographics of the people coming through. Well, it forces you to evolve as a person, as a coach." Otherwise, if you don't, well, you're just going to continually fight it, and you just don't get anywhere.
Yeah. You've never been one to have regrets in life, but when you reflect, do you think you might have taken another path? Tony Kelly, who was then the chairman of the Lions, knocking on your door the way he did to replace Lee Matthews as coach, time over again, would you still say yes?
Yeah, I'd definitely go on that path towards trying to build my own skill sets as a coach, and I understand that better, the difference between that player and that coach, than probably what I did then. Yeah. I think I've certainly been on record to say that I would take a different path.
So not accept the senior job.
Yeah, I'd step away from that, not accepting it. It's just a really interesting when it's offered. Like that,
how do you say no?
How do you say no?
And with Lee's endorsement too.
Lee's endorsement, my old club. Yeah, it's fine to sort of sit back and sort of say with hindsight, yeah. in me, no, I wouldn't. But
because you won a final too.
Yeah, and then first year we play in the finals.
Exciting MCG final against Carlton.
Yeah, and so that was at the Gabba, and then we come down and played the Bulldogs, we lost to the Bulldogs in MCG. But look, it's at the time it felt right. But, you know, in hindsight we know that we probably would have done something different. And But I've never for one moment regretted it.
Yeah.
I've never lived like that.
No.
You make decisions, you follow through on it, you give it the best you can, if it doesn't work out, then so be it. But I'm not one to sit on the couch and wonder. I'll never be that person. And I realise that probably over that time, that view was always going to grate against some. But, you know, whenever you're trying to create something new, you're always butting against existing beliefs.
Yeah.
And if you butt against existing beliefs, you're going to hit confrontation until you can change that opinion. Now, the only thing I'm disappointed was I couldn't change that opinion probably, but that would be the only thing that I'd be look back and sort of say, I wish I could have done it for that reason. But yeah, for me, it's about at times it's taking some risks and showing a little bit of courage in doing things, but also being aware of your surroundings in your environment. And it was certainly a challenging environment at that particular time.
Yeah, it was for so many reasons. Your relationship with Lee Matthews and the impact he's had on you as a footballer, primarily or firstly, and then probably more importantly as a person. Can I get you to please reflect on that?
To sort of summarise, I guess, Lee's impact on me. I mean, I don't speak to him every day. I don't, but he's almost like a second father figure to me. I just learn an enormous amount off him. I guess Lee is just such a leader of men. And he subtly taught me all these subtle ways on how to lead. And whether it's through a phone call or a coffee or not talking to me or he had a way of being able to do that. But the thing that also Lee had was he had presence. That's without doubt, and still probably has that. But he's so pragmatic in his views that it's hard to disagree with him. I never won an argument against him, never ever. I always come in with a strong argument and lost every time and come out agreeing with him. Such was his pragmatism. But he was so good at being able to just make it sound really simple. And then he could go into a room and he could communicate it really clear in a really simple format that everyone understood, which got everyone on the same page. I still think that was one of his real genuine strengths. And he wasn't too bad at the man management side of things. He managed Acura in a different way. It was the first time I'd heard a terminology, and he probably won't like me saying this, Acura, but as a consultant. But it was his way of being able to manage everyone else when we were all going to Lee saying, mate, are we going to keep putting up with this? And his response was, no, he makes us better. He's right. Not necessarily the team player that we have, but you know, we've got to look at him as a consultant. He has a special set of skills that he brings to the table, but he's not necessarily intertwined into how the team operates.
I've never heard that term used on anyone on a football list.
Yeah.
Though we knew what was going on.
Yeah, but that's the way that he spoke to us. And
it made sense to deal with it that way,
doesn't
it?
Made sense to us. Yeah. And that might sound a little bit disparaging to
Acker. It's not.
It's actually not. No. But he made us better, and we bought into that concept.
And look, I was obviously going to raise the name Jason Ackermanis somewhere here. I wasn't sure how, but you raised it before I got to it. You were so close. So you grew up together in Queensland, and I know how much it hurt you when that blew up. I mean, you were torn, weren't you, when that moment reached its crescendo? And you know, you had private and obviously public conversations about him and with him. Is it one of those regrets that you've learnt from? Is it? How do you look back on
that? No, that was an interesting difference in leadership. You know, there was a coach and a player that were at odds with one another, and I was the captain in the middle. It was actually a really difficult scenario to try and manage. But there was a point where I felt that it was starting to become damaging to the group. And so a call needed to be made.
Yep.
Now, whether Lee made that with the support of us or it was encouraged, it doesn't really matter. The reality is it couldn't go on.
Yep. And you said that at the time.
Yeah, it just couldn't go on. And so a call had to be made because, you know, the team was the thing that was getting hurt the most. So And so, you know, the call was made, well and truly supported by myself and a lot of others. And that put at odds my relationship with Jason. I didn't receive some favourable messages from him, and that's fair enough. But, you know, the one thing we could never compromise was what the team was about, and it was getting seriously compromised at that particular time. So it was pretty tough, but it was needed.
Have you patched things up to a point?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, we still catch up every year. You know, we try to have a time on the Thursday before the grand finals. You might be aware of one of those, Damo. we catch up and, you know, we talk, because the reality is that, you know, it's like with Chris and Brad and Scott, that is, and, you know, I don't call them every day, but yet when I catch up with them, we could sit there and talk for hours. It's just, you just have this innate
connection
with people because you've played in the premiership, and that's the one thing that, you know, you can't necessarily share with players is about what's this permanent connection that you have with one another once you win a premiership together, and so we'll always have that.
Yeah, you mentioned the Akimanis thing there. Another one, when you're a coach, you again as coaches are forced to do, and Mick Moldhouse has always been one to subscribe to. You have to make decisions on the run sometimes, but you make them with the right intent. You made a big call on another mate, Daniel Bradshaw, at a time, which obviously impacted on a relationship there. Would you do that again?
I would have no problem doing it if it involved a player that I knew and it was required.
Yeah.
I had more of the problem in how it eventuated and sort of the Chinese whispers out there. So I was more disappointed in myself over that because I didn't follow through on my word.
Right.
And the scenario changed a couple of days later. I'm comfortable that it was communicated, but you know, I've probably since found out that there were some other things that were going on I was not aware of that might have led to him thinking that I wasn't telling him the truth.
Right.
But in my eyes, it was the clear truth. Mm. But I do wish that I followed through on my word. That's my only that's the only thing I reflect on and sort of say that I would do differently. But you know, if a situation ever presented where you have to represent the club and the team and you've got to make a call, well, I've just since that time I've just said, just be honest, you know, like just be and follow through on your word. And that's, you know, I learned a lot out of that particular scenario. And you know, any time I was faced with the same situation, that's what I was. You know, I probably had a similar situation even with Luke Power and having to probably have a conversation around whether he should retire or not. And I just thought it was really important just to be honest through that conversation. And if you're honest and upfront, then hopefully the relationship certainly you know, they might not like it at the time, but they certainly understand in the long term.
Mm. And just for those listening who don't know what we're referring to, there was the whole Brendan Favola time.
Yeah.
You brought him to the club. That didn't work out for reasons beyond your control. But it did spark football there for a period of time when he was on song there for that half season, didn't it?
Yeah, well, we were having sort of 32,000 people at the Gabba, and we had a great membership base. Yeah, it was interesting time. I mean, it's, you know, I heard Brad talking the other day, and he was talking about you know, building hope, staying competitive. You know, the football club that can afford to go down, you know, and trying to still sell a hope message and still sell a competitive message. It's really difficult when you're at a club that needs to, you know, when finances become and stay relevant. And Brisbane market's been that like that forever. You know, really fortunately, they certainly look like they're working their way through that, which is fantastic. But that whole market there is just a different market. And I don't think that's necessarily – I think it's become appreciated from AFL House, but I think it's taken a really long time to get there to do that. It's a different market, and you have to stay relevant. Mm. And so, yeah, it was a decision that was made to get him up, and it didn't work. And it certainly was not a great decision to get him there. And it didn't work for him, and it certainly didn't work for us.
Mm. Back to the playing career. The conversation couldn't be had unless three names were mentioned: Voss, Buckley, and Hurd. There was a bond there at the time that might have been distant. It's still there in some form now. Are you close to those guys? Have you conversed in recent times?
Not in recent times. Not with Hurdy recently. Bucks is every now and then conversation. Again, not all the time. I think people forget a little bit that of Bucks's time.
You were teammates.
Teammates and actually mates.
You said Chapman. You learned something from him even at that 1993 year.
He was an intense character that I've ever come across. I remember going back home to chat to my dad, and God, Dad, I don't know whether I can be like that. if I have to be that intense, I don't know whether I want to be that good a player.
Because you'd played in 92, played six games in your debut year.
Yeah.
Wearing number 56.
Yes, that's correct.
And then Nathan Buckley walks into the footy club in 93.
Yeah. But I think he was in another way so good for our football club too, because he came in with a real confidence in the way that he played. He came in with a real presence, but he came in with this real determination. I think that really grated on a lot of people at the time, and unfortunately so, because we desperately needed it. Mm. We needed players that we could look at and sort of say, geez, that's a pretty impressive work rate. His passion for football was unbelievable. And so it sort of taught me a new level of by just observing, not so much about what he was saying or necessarily doing, but just observing him saying, oh, I've got to go to another level here. This guy's walked in, he works his absolute butt off, he does all the extras, he loves footy and he's so intense. And sometimes that intensity did overflow for him.
Which he now concedes.
Yeah, which he now concedes, and you clearly see him as a leader today. But, the way he goes about it is, everyone talks how fantastic that is. I sort of guess as a young player, and I was, 17, 18, so I was pretty young when you're coming to talking about football, and got to learn about Nathan Buckley and what he did. And he was a 21-year-old man that taught me a lot of things. And so on the back of that, even though he left, that really stayed with me.
Yeah. And when you refer there, you went home and spoke to your dad, Gary, about that intensity. Can you recall some of the specifics of what really made you step up and notice how this man was driven?
Not so much. It was more his training intensity. Like when he trained, it was for keeps. He just, every time he walked on the park, he was training like he was going to play that day. And he just had a football in his hands all the time. Now, as growing up as a kid, I used to do that a little bit myself. But as you start to come into AFL, you can sometimes forget about the love of the game and how important the love of the game is, playing it, because it turns into somewhat a job. But this guy had a love of the game, and that was the thing that that was really striking to me. And the first thing I knew that I had to do, if I was going to be a consistent AFL player, then my training had to go to another level.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Michael, the three premierships in a row, the first one, I would say for obvious reasons, the most important. Is that fair to say?
It was significant breakthrough. I mean, and it's significant breakthrough in different in a different way to what might be you might think. For me, growing up in Queensland, you're ridiculed as an AFL player. I mean, it's a very different landscape today for kids playing AFL football in Queensland what it was in 1987. We had two kids in the whole school playing. Rugby league was dominant, and rugby union. There wasn't another language spoken. And if you were playing that other game, you're ridiculed. So to be able to sort of work our way through all that and then have win a premiership and then just see this wave of momentum and sentiment about our game and the explosion of participation was probably the most proudest part of it all. And the fact that, yeah, this kid that grows up in Queensland, driving down the freeway, getting picked up from some teammates that on the way down to Carrara and having 300 people turn up, half my school didn't even know what I was doing, even though I was in year 11 at school, you know, and then be this guy standing on the dais at the MCG and then coming back and going having a Tikitet parade down the middle of Queen Street Mall with, you know, thousands of people lining the streets. I mean, that's something else because you've changed people's minds. You've changed people's views about our game. And, you know, that's something that I'll always really hold dear to me, even more so than the premiership itself.
Really? Yeah.
Absolutely.
But the only thing you didn't personally achieve was win a Norm Smith medal. But I reckon when people look back at maybe the first two and maybe all three, there's a case to be made you could have won a couple of them as well.
Case, but I don't have it. I think at the start of an AFL grand final, all you're worried about is you don't actually play on the guy who wins a Norm Smith medal.
That's in the gut, is it?
The fear factor. You know, you're as much about managing your fear as anything else on that day. And certainly my anxiety levels and fear levels was more around, gee, I hope I don't get to play on the guy who actually wins an Norm Smith medal, which actually
– he played on Bucks.
Coincidentally, it was me, which is the one everyone suggests that I should have won. That was a fantastic contest on the day and went to a worthy winner. And all of them did. So it's sort of to state a case for yourself, you almost have to state a case against why someone else wouldn't. And I couldn't do that.
Yeah. I could kick five in one of those and didn't win one too, didn't he?
Yeah, but he ran around the whole last quarter saying he should have been the Norm Smith medalist. So, I mean, he'd already announced himself at three-quarter time, let alone afterwards. But, you know, a performance of 39 disposals, you know, it's pretty impressive too.
Yes, it was by the bloke who won it, Simon Black. Just getting back to that sick feeling before a game, was that every game?
No, I guess I learnt to manage that over time. But always had fear about what could happen in the game. Was I good enough?
As the best absolutely. Or near best, you still had that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what if I get beaten today?
Hmm.
All those seeds of doubt that run through your mind before a game. And eventually I think as maturity, you start to mature your thoughts and you start to think a little bit more around what you got to do. But also as you start to mature, you start to realise that I don't even know why I'm thinking about the game until I actually get to do something about it.
Right. So is it wasted energy?
So it becomes wasted energy. You know, and you can build yourself up a lot. But in the end, the only time you actually get to do anything about it is when the siren sounds and it's go time. So I was very much sort of just become really clear on what I needed to do. And mine was pretty simple. Like I just had to hit body as early as I possibly could in the game and as many times as I could. And the other part was that whatever got me in the game, whether that was with my mouth or
I was going to say that was a key part of
my body. Yeah, it was like I had to target someone in my own mind. And once I had that target in my mind and once I had that couple of things that I wanted to focus on, then I just let it happen. And, you know, it doesn't always work, clearly. You don't go out and play a great game every game you play. But certainly I sort of the more mature you become, you realise that period before the game is actually wasted emotion.
Mm. When you watch Gary Ablett now, who's clearly at the tail end of his career and yet still being able to get three, I'm assuming, Brownlow medal votes quite possibly in the most recent weeks in which we're speaking, can you relate to that older player when the body just can't do what it once could but the mind wants to take you there? He's working out a way, as we speak anyway, a way to do it. How skillful do you need to be to be doing what he's doing?
Oh, well, that speaks to his longevity. Amazing. I mean, we've sort of – Roger Federer, maybe we're learning how to do this, mate, but we're talking about freaks of nature here, aren't we? Like you're putting up some serious names who have the capacity to be able to do that. But, yeah, no doubt there's a slowing down period and you still feel like you're going as fast because the mind's still operating as clearly as it needs to, but the body just doesn't go as quick as it used to. And I'm still sure that despite as good as he's going, can you believe it, there's probably things that Gaz would still like to be doing more of that he once could do that he can't do now. But I'm really pleased that we're actually appreciating – Gary for what he's doing and how he plays, and appreciate him for the player that he is, not so much what he was.
Yeah.
Because, you know, often the biggest enemy you fight is actually your own success. And when you're coming off a pedestal in Gary Ablett, you know, it's a pretty big to live up to, but somehow he's doing it. It's pretty incredible.
Who of the modern great, Vossi, is it that you most like watching?
Oh, of the greats.
Is it Dusty? Is it five?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of variety of guys. No one's sort of really jumping out at me, I've got to say, although if I'm watching football, I am still a football lover, so you still appreciate the amazing acts you see on the football field. And you know, whether that's I hope you don't get to see it tonight, but whether that's De Goey and, you know, and some of these power that he has, and I don't know whether I necessarily I guess I don't necessarily look at all clubs or anything like that. I guess Isaac Heaney is one, and of all the current players that I look at, he resembles me more than any other, I think. So I sort of probably just like to watch him because I think he's I had some attributes I think that he has. So
that'd be big for him to be described by you as someone that you like.
Yeah, I just love watching him play. You know, he's not the most skillful, but he's certainly very competent. But he's tough and he's clean, and I like, he's good overhead, can go forward and kick goal if he needs to. I think he's a wonderful talent that'll only get better and better. But generally, I just appreciate the stars. You know, whether that's Gaz doing what Gaz does with the skill that he's got, or whether that's De Goey and his power. And hopefully, I don't see much of that tonight.
Okay. Now, I didn't quite get an answer to that question I did ask you about 25 minutes ago. Are you ready to coach again, senior level?
No, I couldn't answer that, Damon, because the reality is that of course if the option's there, you'd explore it. But I couldn't shift my mind there because it's just not because it's just, so it's the hypothetical, could have been, you know, option. And I just, I've just never been hardwired that way. It's not avoiding the answer. I think the obvious way to answer that is that I did answer it in the way that, yes, clearly I got back into this to be a head coach again. I've said that more than on one occasion. But I'm also the guy that knows that the job's going to get done now. And that's where your sole focus has got to lie. And we've got a big job at hand. And
that's where the competitive boost is still.
That's right.
You.
Yeah, and you've got the exciting – we've got an exciting group to work with. And every day you rock up and you're still looking for a better way of how to do things and how we should handle the week and plot the downfall of Collingwood and then go into the next week. And that's what we live by. But I also understand at the same time, you know, part of the media is forecasting and sort of looking forward about what could happen and what might not happen. And I did that only for a short little while. But in the main, we live in the now and we have to deal with the now and we have to make the most of it. And that's what they'll get.
Yeah. Michael, appreciate your time today and for always your professionalism and honesty and integrity with which you've carried yourself and been open in this In The Game podcast.
Thanks for your time, mate.